Welcome to another episode of My Immortality Matters, the voices and lives of Black men. I've been away for a while, I'm sure you've noticed, and I am deep into my dissertation research as I am obtaining my PhD in human sexuality studies. My research study is exploring young Black men's perceptions of the connections between structural violence, mental health, and sexual behavior. In this study, I will look at how do young Black men see these connections, and I will also explore heterosexual men and men who have sex with men and their similarities and differences in seeing these connections. So I am currently interviewing men from all over the country, and it's going amazing, and I cannot wait to share my research results with you and what I'm finding and what the men were saying and getting their voices out into the world. Tonight, I have a guest that I believe everyone needs to know. You need to meet him. You need to spend some time with him because he makes you look great. He makes you feel good about yourself. And he listens to you. I am talking about my barber. My barber's name is Nafis Williams, better known as Nafis the Barber. Getting a haircut for a Black man is like, I don't know, one of the most amazing things that we do weekly, bi-weekly in some cases, because you leave the barbershop and you feel invincible. You know you look good, and normally you have the new haircut smell as you walk out the barbershop. The barbershop is also the place where there are a lot of new beginnings that happen. The first time a father or mother or parents together bring their son to the barbershop is a new beginning. And watching a young kid get his hair cut, sometimes they're crying and the barber's trying to console him, or the parents are trying to console him to keep his head still, to not move around as much. It's a passageway that we probably don't talk about a lot enough, but the passageway for young Black boys and for us men to understand the power of grooming, the influence of looking good and smelling good. And so in the barbershop, that's where that happens. And I've been going to the barbershop weekly since my dad would take my brothers and I when I was a kid. And now as an adult, I've gone to the barbershop every week to get a haircut until the pandemic happened last year. And the barbershop was closed, obviously. But then I grew my hair out. And so now I go now like once every 3 weeks. But I still love going for the conversation, for this time in this space. And so tonight's conversation with Nafis the Barber is going to be about the barbershop. It's going to be about how Black men experience racism. It's going to be about Nafis's experiences in some of these areas. And it's a wide-ranging discussion that we're going to have. So I am excited about it. I'm excited that he is here and that we are ready to talk to you about the life of Black men, and that our voices and our lives do matter. Tell you a little bit about who he is, how he got started in the business of cutting hair, and then we can have a series of questions for him for our time together. So, Nafis, what's up, young man?
Hey, what's going on, Dr. John Teller? I'm having a good day. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing well. So tell us a little about yourself. Who are you? What brings you to the work you do?
Well, who I am, I'm a child of God, Jesus Christ, actually, by way of Denise and Albert Williams. But besides that, I'm a barber. I've been a barber for 21 years. I started barbering, actually had scholarships to college for basketball. I turned them down because I knew that I always been a person who knew what I always wanted to do what I wanted to do. So if I didn't want to do it, I wasn't going to do it to my full ability. So only reason why I was going to go to college was to play basketball and pledge, you know, and have parties. Like, that's what I wanted to do.
Right.
I mean,
right.
you got to be real with yourself.
Right.
So I decided that wasn't a good idea. So one day I went to a barbershop with my brother's friend. Oh, no. I was going to go to the service. The day I was supposed to leave, the girl I was dating at that time asked me to not go. So I didn't go.
Really?
Really, yep. So I went to a barbershop with my brother, and his friend was a barber in Philadelphia. And, you know, he dressed fly. You know, everybody in there was waiting for him. I said, this is what I want to do. I had no idea how much barbers need. I had no idea. You know, I just knew that I wanted to be cool like him, and I wanted to have people waiting for
him. So. Okay. That's a reason, right?
Yeah. Right, right. That was a reason. So there you go. That's how I became a barber.
That's interesting, the way you fell into that work, sounds like. Were you cutting hair before then?
No, like, I never. Not at all.
Any idea?
Not at all. I didn't know how to do anything. At that time, all I knew how to do was play basketball and get girls. Get women.
Okay.
Well, girls at the time. Yep.
Yeah. But I guess it's also interesting to think about, you turned down the scholarship, and your girlfriend said no, you didn't go to the Army as well.
Yes. Yes. It's amazing how life turns out for us, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So when you think about, like, life, how life turns out for us, it's a good segue to the conversation we're going to have today, looking at how we as Black men show up in the world and how the world shows up towards us as well. So, you know, last year we had the death of George Floyd, right? And I think we all could not unsee what we saw in that case. And also other Black men who have died at the hands of the police, through police violence, excessive force, the list goes on. How do you think that has impacted you, seeing these things from the lens of a Black man?
It opened my eyes up. So, like, once again, I go back to me being realistic, right? Mm-hmm. I know these things happen. Like, when these things happen, I'm not shocked. Like, oh my gosh, I can't believe this just happened again, right? Mm-hmm. For me, it's now that it's broadcasted worldwide. You know, now I get to actually see it. You know, and so that, the way I don't think it affected me, I think that it just showed me that these things are still real. Guard yourself. Be protected. Understand what's going on.
Mm-hmm. But when you think about understand what's going on, does that mean you have to be more vigilant in some ways? Is that what that means?
No, understanding means knowledgeable, right?
Okay. All
right. To whereas though, don't be oblivious that these things, don't be naive that these things don't happen. You know, being that this is a country that I feel as though isn't, the laws aren't for us.
Mm-hmm.
I have kids, you know, I have to tell them how to conduct themselves just as well as I have to know how to conduct myself, which is a shame, you know. Others don't have to carry themselves the way we have to carry ourselves. So we gotta stay cognizant of that.
Right. No, that's I think it's pretty interesting, because when you think about you have kids, and so as a child, did your parents talk to you about this stuff, like police and racism? And
not at all. You know, I think I had family members who may have mentioned it, but no one sat me down and actually talked to me about it.
How do you feel about that, not having that conversation?
You know, I don't feel any type of way about it, you know, because at that time we were living in different times. You know, there's a lot of things that I look back and I say, and I'm pretty sure we all do, we could say, man, damn, I wish my mom or dad would have said this. I wish my aunt or uncle would have said this. You know, but I come from the era of go to college, get good grades, stay out of trouble, working 9 to 5. You know, so towards though now, the information age, you know, internet and everything else, I can touch what's going on in China. You know, back in those times, we couldn't touch what was going on in China. We couldn't touch what was going on in India. Right. You know, so now there's things that I've seen, of course, from traveling as well, that now I can have those conversations with my kids.
Mm-hmm.
You so, know, so if... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Sorry, finish your thought.
No, I'm just... So I don't blame the generation before me. I actually applaud them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they still had a way about them that they try to teach us to stay on the right path.
Right. So how old are you when you say back in the day or in those times?
I'm 39.
39? Okay. All right.
I'm 39.
Young man you are. That's good. All right. So, with your kids, are you telling about these conversations about what to look out for, how to protect themselves in the world? Are you sharing that with your sons now or your kids now?
Yes. It's a funny situation because my mom actually tries to talk to them more than I do, right? Like, she's teaching them things that I thought I should have been taught, but, you know, she, like I said, she's more advanced and educated now because of the internet and, you know, things that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I have those conversations with my children, just trying to educate them on how to conduct yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I see situations where it's a movie out, American Skin. I'm not sure if you've seen that.
No, I haven't seen that yet. I write that down.
Okay, you have to see that, right?
Okay. All right.
And so what happened was, The father, they lived in a bad neighborhood. I'm not going to say a bad neighborhood. They lived in a neighborhood that wasn't the suburbs. His son went to a suburban school, right? Mm-hmm. Which is a great school. And his dad took a job as a janitor so his son could go to a suburban school.
Hmm.
Right?
Uh-huh.
And so what happened was, and what we do as now as parents, we try and give our kid something better than what we had.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
So now you're torn, right? Because now this guy has put his son in a suburban school, right? So he really doesn't understand. He doesn't see life how a black person really sees life,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And so he thinks, oh yeah, you know, in class we learned that everybody has a right to talk back to a cop or say something to a cop. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And the dad, he's on a Zoom call with his friend, and dad steps in the room and says, wait a minute, son, you can't say that. Like, can you say it? Is it right? You should be able to say that? Yes. But can you say it? No.
Right.
Right? Uh-huh. So he doesn't understand because he's never seen these things happen. It doesn't seem real to him because of the environment that he's in.
Gotcha. Okay. Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
So they drive in the neighborhood. He just picked his son up from his friend's house who lived in a suburban neighborhood. So they driving and the cops pull him over. The cop gets him out the car and he's telling his son, put your phone away. Put your phone down. He's yelling it to him.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And the cop shoots him.
Shoots who?
The kid.
Whoa.
Right?
Right.
So I'm painting that picture because there's some things in that I reflect to my sons about. One is, if I tell you to do something, you do it. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But that goes to how, as a black man, how we're raised, right?
Right, right.
Every
yeah.
time every time my parents told me to do something, they always said it this way. You know, instead of explaining to me, you know, and so now when I have my kids, I'm trying to explain it to them. I'm trying to give them leeway to where though they can question when I tell them to do something.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
So that's the torn part when you're trying to give your kid a better life, but you're also trying to not bring them up the way that you were brought up. And so to some degree, like give them a little leeway.
And so sometimes you think sometimes because that happens, like trying to grow them up differently in a way, that some of the things the kids may need to know, they miss.
Yep.
And that could put them in danger later.
That could put them in danger. Like, if I tell you to do something, don't say, hey, dad, why? Or, you sure? Or, no, just do it.
Okay.
We could talk about later why I told you to do that. Right?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
So
yeah.
So that's so yeah, so back to your original question about the racism, you know, that's why I have conversations with my kids is if I tell you to do something, mm-hmm. just do it. Mm-hmm. We'll figure everything else out later.
Mm-hmm. And do
respect,
you
respect authority, respect all kinds of authority. Anybody older than you, respect them.
I think that's a good lesson though, to teach kids because, you know, authority figures can come in all sides, like teachers, police people, older adults. And I guess having that lesson learned at home can like help them out in the world to kind of like be better, do better, and kind of see better. But also, I guess you also talk to them about like standing up for themselves as well. If they are wronged, like standing up for themselves. So how do you tell them to do that in a way that keeps them safe?
I'll say that one more time, John.
Like you tell your children, like, okay, respect authority and all of those things. At the same time, do you teach them how to stand up for themselves in a way that also is safe? Because sometimes authority is not right. So how do you help them navigate how to manage that when authority figures have gone, we say, rogue in some cases?
Well, the thing is, you can stand up for yourself, but it's a time and place. When you're dealing with your peers, you stand up for yourself. When you deal with any kind of authority, you let them have it, and you come back and you let me deal with it because they're my peers.
Gotcha. Okay. That's good. That's good advice. So how do you feel like then when you think about authority in your life in some cases? Have you ever experienced racism before in your life, discrimination before? And if so, what happened and how did you deal with that?
I'm gonna tell you what happened and you tell me what you think I went through, right? Because
okay,
to be honest with you, I can't say directly. It was maybe stereotype. I'm not sure if okay. racism played a part of it. Okay. So I was on a plane and I was going, I can't remember where I was going, and I was in first class. And this guy owned the business. I know a business because a couple of my clients frequent his business. So he owns a business and he said to me, "What did you do? How did you get up in first class?"
What?
Right. And
was it? Wow.
And in my head, I was thinking, "What are you? I got here the same way you got here." You know? Right. Yeah. So then I said, "What do you do?" And he went on to tell me what he did. I said, "Oh yeah, well, you know, a couple of my clients, they come to you." And he's a suit guy. I said, "Yeah, come on, my client, go." And I started giving names. And then he was like, "Oh, okay." So then I guess it was a validation of who I was. But that's one of the things that has happened. I can't say that I've actually, somebody said, you know, done anything racist or said anything racist off the top of my head. But that's one of the situations I've been in where as though I was looked at like I didn't belong.
Yeah, that's been interesting because a lot of people are going to hear this and think like there's no way this black guy can say he's not experienced racism before, you know, outright racism. But I think it's interesting when you recall this story, like this guy almost felt like, "I'm here, you don't belong, or how did you get here too?" In a way,
right?
And that could be either stereotyping, some form of racism, or oppression in some cases. But the more like the idea of feeling like you don't belong, and if so, how? Kind of you had to kind of like justify the reason you were able to have the seat you had on
correct.
The plane.
Correct.
Did you feel offended? Were you pissed off?
I mean,
what'd you feel?
I felt like I was taken back. Like, yo, who the F are you, dude? Like, you know, I'm from Philly. Like, you know, it's
right.
Like, what do you mean? You know, so right. I guess I was taken back. So yeah, I was probably offended at the time. Mm-hmm. You know. But believe it or not, that has happened more than once on the plane, sitting in first class. Normally for that example, I knew who the guy was, so I had a name drop. But normally I tell people I'm a trash truck driver.
You do? Why do you have, okay.
tell people to
say more about that identity.
I don't know. It's just fun. You know, I say I'm a trash truck driver. Maybe I picked up the trash a couple times. You know, it's just fun.
But why do you do that? I am curious now.
Because I don't. Because
I also have an alter ego when I fly. I work at the Gap when I fly.
I don't want to give people the satisfaction of feeling like they. I just don't want to give people the satisfaction, you know, of knowing what I do or how I got where I got. You know, I'm sitting here. Doesn't matter.
So it's almost like you feel like you don't have to answer to them for where you are.
Right.
And if you told them you did something else, they said, oh, that makes sense. So that's why.
Right, exactly.
Okay. Now that's a neat perspective. I haven't thought about that way. But I tell folks that I work at the Gap because I'm a therapist. I don't want to hear people's problems. So I say, I work at the Gap. It's like, oh, okay, they leave me alone. And I love the Gap. I shop at the Gap. No, you know, I'm not making any digs towards the Gap. It's just easier for people to not ask me about my my life. But so when you think about, like, you know, that experience and those things in your life, what role do you feel like is any role of stigma or internalized racism that may go with you in your life in any way?
Say that again.
Do you feel like there's any way of any role that stigma plays in your life? Stigma as being a black male, stigma as being any of those ways shows
for
up.
Sure.
You?
So my son goes to a black a very, very, both of my sons go to a very, very predominant school, predominantly white school. And it's very, it's one of the top schools actually in the tri-state area. And so I have to make sure that my family and I are always at parent-teacher. We're always at an event, you know, because I don't want to be the black father who's not around.
Huh. And so is that about like the idea that this idea that black fathers are absent from their children's life? And when we know research shows that black fathers are more prevalent in their children's life.
Yeah.
But like, do you feel like because that's why you show up to kind of like not give that negative idea, like, where's the dad?
Exactly. Exactly. You know, because of that stereotype, because of that stigma, you know, I want people to know that, no, there's black fathers around. You know, this black kid is very loved and supported. You know, he's not here because some white guy gave him, you know, a bunch of money to come here and he's his puppy poster child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But was that in some ways like, I don't know, does that annoy you that you have to do that?
No, I mean, I should so be there. Not at all. I should be there.
Right.
You know, but it's just the sad part is that these type of things are thought about.
Right.
You know, it might be a day where I don't feel like going. You know, I really don't. You know, white, it's funny because you don't see any white fathers. You see mostly white mothers.
Oh, huh. Yeah. Okay. So we think about, like, your presence there and having, you know, feel like you want to be there and be there for your son. I think it's great that you are in that presence. What is one thing you would tell your younger self now about your life? You were able to talk to young Nazis, age, we say, 10 years old, 14. What would you tell them about life as you know it?
I would say invest your money. Invest every dime that you got into the stock market. Save money and buy land. Don't have any kids until you're married. Those would be the three things that I would definitely say.
Why would those be some of the lessons, the things you would tell him about having kids till you're married? What is that about for you?
I think that coming from, so now this is deep. Now this is gonna be this is a good conversation, right?
Okay.
First, I believe you should have kids till you're married in your late 30s, right? So whereas though, your early 20s, you fuck up, you mess up, right? Mm-hmm. Mid 20s to late 20s, you're figuring out who you are. What do you really want to do? Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Early 30s, you meet your partner, and y'all travel and learn each other. Mm-hmm. And then your late 30s, y'all are settled and now starting a family. Now that timeline is I mean, of course, you know, that comes and goes. That timeline, that's in the perfect world, right? But
that's
the blueprint that I'm putting out there, right? Just like the blueprint I'm putting out there for my career, right? The things that we do is we say these things and we say, oh, that's not realistic, but it is realistic. You know, the same way you're going to become a doctor or a lawyer, you put out a blueprint on how you're going to achieve that in the years that it's going to take. Right. Mm-hmm. So I think that having a child being married, the child needs both parents. Right. Mm-hmm. Both parents that are on the same path, the same career goal, the same goals pair as a family. So and it's good to have that in the same house. Now, can you raise a kid? Can y'all raise a kid from co-parenting? Sure. Right. But it's still not the same as having two parents in a household that are both positive. Now, don't get me wrong, there are some parents that had kids and the household was just in shambles. I'm talking about the household where the mother and father on the same goal, same path. You know, raising kids from different households is hard. You know, it's hard. Mm-hmm. You want to be there every night. You don't want to have to wait till the weekend to go over what they did on Monday in school.
Right, yeah, because you can start in that scenario, you're missing something, right, in the child's life, in their daily life, that you're waiting for the weekend to show up to see. Yes. But also, I think it's interesting as you laid your timeline out, you know, the ages of 20s and 30s, and how people could find their plan for their life. I think a lot of that seems to go into like identity, like because you are as you are younger, you're understanding who you are. And almost seems like as you are getting older, you come to a more understanding of this is who I am, this is what I want for my life, and you can make better decisions as you're aging. And so hopefully then you'll find the life partners also making those same kind of decisions that you're making for your life.
Yep.
And creating, and then having children that's kind of like create that bond even stronger for you.
Yes. Yes.
I like that plan. So how do you feel like then you think when you think about that idea, right? And as a barber and you're in the barbershop, these conversations are happening about relationships and how do you navigate those conversations then? Do you bring this view up to people? Do you say this out loud to other people, or this is your internal?
No, I definitely say it out loud. No, it's always a conversation. I mean, you know how we rock and roll, John. You know, I'll just be myself. You know, and I don't say anything to hurt anyone. And you know, it's just like, hey, man, what do you think about this? You know, because I feel like if especially the Black community, if we got a blueprint on how, of course, things happen in life and you gotta alter your blueprint, right? But if you get a blueprint, if you get one blueprint of how you want things to go and they change, that's something different. When you get a blueprint on how you want things to go and you follow that blueprint, you can be successful. You know, one thing growing up in a Black community back in the early 90s was, in the 80s and 90s was, get a lot of girls, Black guy gets a lot of girls, he's the man, right? But nobody told you the problems that came along with that.
Right.
You know, the things that you're going to run up against with that thought process.
Right. But you know, that's not really shown a lot, like the downside of that. But it also goes into this idea of the man box, right? What the things that society says men are to be and should be. And then men strive to be that box guy. But the reality of it is no one lives in a box. We're not square people. So trying to meet an agenda that way oftentimes leads somewhere to like disaster in people's lives or a lot of depression and anxiety in some ways. But I wonder when you think about this blueprint, it's not like you say people should have a business plan for their life. Like, we create business plans for businesses. So for your life, create some of the same kind of idea. Like, what do you want to do? Goals, plans to get there in some ways?
Correct. Correct. You know, how to achieve these goals, you know? Mm-hmm. As I get older, you know, I hear people, you know, it's interesting. Now I hear these conversations, right? But I didn't hear these conversations when I was younger. You know, hey, man, don't chase the money. I mean, don't chase the women. You know, if you get money, the women are going to come, right? You know, mm-hmm. like I said, right. like I keep referencing is women was always the priority in my life. That was the picture that was painted for me as what a man is. The cool guy, the man, right?
Right.
So,
right.
So me chasing women took away from me making money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially when you have multiple. When you have multiple, you got to think about, hey, I'm having multiple dates. That's multiple amounts of money going out, right? Which is taken away from my goal.
And also lots of time.
And lots of time.
You dated multiple people.
Lots of time. Which is taken away from my goal.
Right.
Taken away from me figuring out who I am. And what I need to do for my life so I can achieve my goals.
Right. So priorities can sometimes be screwed when you're focused on some of the wrong things at times.
Correct. Well, yeah,
Right. You can, you know, sometimes you can get left behind or forget what your real agenda is.
Yep.
That's pretty fascinating. Because I think, you know, these things we see a lot in movies. These things I hear about a lot. But I think, like, being able to, like, put it into words in that simple of a phrase, I think it's really good how you frame that. So that's helpful. So what's one of the things you think you would say to what's one positive thing you would say about Black men?
We're not cheaters.
You were. you gotta say more than that. Come on. What does that mean? We're not cheaters.
I'm just joking. You know the whole stereotype, Black men cheat. You know, yeah, we're not cheaters.
Yeah.
One thing about Black men, I think we're strong. We're like MacGyvers, you know. Mm. We we're not like the Black woman. The Black woman's something powerful, like the most powerful person in the world, right?
Amazing, yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
But we have we're powerful as well. Like our strength, our features, you know, our knowledge. You know, most of the things that were made in America and built was built off of our backs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think that's if I was to describe a Black man, that's how I would describe us. Powerful.
Okay.
Knowledgeable.
That's good. Yeah. And you said just now that Black women are the most powerful forces. Do you think they realize that, the power that they
have? Yes, I think they do. And I think they're fed up knowing that they are the most powerful, the most dynamic person in the world, and aren't being protected, aren't being, you know, appreciated, should I say, appreciated.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I think it's one thing, and I think, you know, seeing Kamala Harris become vice president.
Oh man, I'm
before you know we have Stacey Abrams, who's like phenomenal in her own right, and there's so many other strong Black women, Michelle Obama, the list goes on. But thinking about how you just said, they realize they are powerful, but also realizing they're not getting respect that they deserve.
Right. And you know I'm not a fan of Kamala. You know that, Josh.
I know you're not. I know you're not.
Use Michelle Obama first. Okay?
Kamala Harris. I know. What'd you say?
Could have used Michelle Obama first. Okay.
But I like Kamala Harris. And I know we had that conversation already before. But I think part of the thing is like looking at what she stands for in the symbolism of being the first vice president who is a Black Asian American person, a Black woman of Asian descent. So, but also when you think about Black men and racism and the power that we also hold, do you have an idea why some Black men don't reach their potential in some cases? What we could hold them back from reaching some of the things that we could do as Black men? Since we are powerful, we built the world, we built things on our back. So, what's holding us back? from seeing out excellence, I guess.
I think I'm oppression. dog just came in the house.
Yeah. So I'll edit that out. That'd be good. Okay, so we can take a pause so I can like.
You want me to just go with the answer?
Okay, so you
just go with the answer.
Yes. Yeah, so hold on. So let me get this right. So hold on a second then. All right, go with the answer.
So I think that oppression is definitely one of the main reasons. We were brainwashed and manipulated to think that we weren't good enough. You know, and I hear people all the time saying, and I was one of these people, oh man, get over it. Slavery was such and such years ago, right? But it's right. Not that just slavery was such so many years ago, but it's the mindset, right? So it's trickled down from generation to generation. That example, I wasn't taught, you know, something. I wasn't taught about credit, right? I didn't learn about credit until I heard of it. Let me say this. I heard of it when I got in my 20s. Mm-hmm. I didn't understand it until I got in my 30s, right? So I can say that, was I in my own way? No, I just didn't have any knowledge. I was ignorant to what was needed.
Right.
And
but I think thinking about, yeah.
No, go ahead.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, John.
But you said something I think is interesting, like, you know, hearing about it in your 20s and not understanding to your 30s, right? So sometimes that can like have us behind in some cases, right?
Oh, for sure.
Because we're not prepared, I guess.
For sure. For these things. And that's why I say things like that. That's just one example of why we're not ahead. You know, of course, not everyone. Some people just don't want to be ahead. Like, let's not put that out there. Let's not forget that. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of cases where we just weren't given the tools to understand what we needed to be ahead.
Mm-hmm. I think you may get pushed back with that idea that some folks don't want to be ahead.
You know, some people don't want to be ahead. Some don't. Some,
why do you say that?
Some like to be content where they're at. Some people think that they made it. You know?
Okay. Uh-huh.
Some people were scared. Some people were scared to get ahead.
Right.
Some people were scared to ask how to get ahead.
Right.
Which goes back to slavery, right? Because of pride, right? Because they demasculated so much a black man in slavery that, you know, some things you don't say and ask about, or even further down the line, coming up, right? Mm-hmm. There are some things you just don't even talk about in your family.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
So that's how some black men aren't ahead. Because some things we're not even supposed to talk about or ask questions about.
Because the idea of you're supposed to already know.
You're supposed to already know.
You're supposed to know how to do it, what to do, how to say it, and all that stuff. But no one tells you the answer. You're supposed to just know these things. Which I think can sometimes have a person set up for failure because they're not prepared for success.
Correct.
And so also, sometimes the fear of being successful can also lead to complacency as well.
Correct.
Yep. And feeling paralyzed in your life because you don't know what to do or how to do it. And so you kind of like find yourself waiting for someone. Waiting.
Yep.
No, that's really good, really fascinating. So one thing I guess I know we've been talking a while, but I don't want to take all your time up today, but I think one of the final questions that I would ask you is for someone hearing the podcast in your conversation today, what's one thing you want them to take away from you and what you have said? What's one takeaway you want them to pick up from this conversation?
Man, you know, we could talk forever, man. Like, for real. I have no problem with that. But I think I just want people to look within and understand who they... The first thing you have to do is understand who you are. Go to therapy. Go to John Taylor. Dr. John Taylor, right? So you can understand and learn who you are. most of us don't know who we are and try and get in relationships, try and have kids, you know, try and do different things in life without understanding who we are. So we don't understand why we're doing these things. Mm-hmm. Right?
And yeah, I agree. And why is it important for people to know who they are, right? Like saying, okay, Prippa, now go find out who you are, understand who you are. Why is that important to know that?
So you understand for relationships, right? For example, relationships. While you understanding who you are and what you like, you know what you won't put up with. You know how you want to be treated. You know how you don't want to be treated. For your career, right? You don't want to go into a career knowing that you don't like doing something. Now it's 2021. You can make money doing anything. So find out what your passion is and do research on how you can make money off of your passion, right? Which means you got to know what you like.
Right.
Your kids, you gotta learn who you are and deal with the past traumas.
Yes, good.
Yep. Deal with the past traumas, right? So you won't be dealing with the generational curses, passing generational curses down.
Right. Okay. Yeah, we see a lot of times when we look at trauma and generations and people maybe have not had those conversations with themselves or other people to try to find some clarity, and you begin to behave outside of who you are. And one thing we do find in therapy is a person is not sure who they are, they will do anything or some things that's outside of their character. But not knowing your character, you are subjected to a lot of negative behavior, I would say.
Right. You take on people, you take on things that you don't like, you know, that you don't want to do. And you don't understand why you keep repeating the same cycle. Because you don't know who you are.
So you become an absorber, a sponge of other people's stuff. Because you don't know what your own stuff is.
Yep.
And there's you have no force field. I think knowing who you are gives you a force field around you. Things that will and will not reside in or around you in your life.
Yep.
So that part, I think, is going to be key to understanding ourselves. Okay, good.
Okay.
And so to wrap up the things for the night, I think like one of the things to think about, as you have said so well earlier, is like the blueprint for life, understanding what you want and then being able to look for that and learn about how to get those things accomplished for yourself.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, definitely learn. Make a blueprint, make a plan for everything. From career to relationship, make a plan. Make a plan for what you want to accomplish in life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Everything takes sacrifice. You gotta be willing to sacrifice what you want as well.
So say more about that sacrifice part.
Sacrifice, you know, you might have to. So I'm an entrepreneur. I'm a barber. You know, when I first started cutting hair, I had to cut hair all day, all night. I couldn't. Like, this is what I needed to do because I couldn't rely on a paycheck. I couldn't rely on a bi-weekly paycheck. You know, I couldn't say, all right, well, I know I'm going to work from 9 to 5. I know if I didn't go out and hand out flyers. I came up in a generation where you handed out flyers. You know?
Right.
Standing on the corner and if I didn't hand out flyers, how am I going to eat? You know, if I don't work all day, all night, how am I going to eat? Uh-huh. You know, so those are the sacrifices that I had to make. I couldn't go hang out with my friends. They work 9 to 5. Once they got off at work at 5, they were going to happy hour. I couldn't do that. You know, I had to work. Mm-hmm. So that's just one of the little sacrifices that I've had to make coming up in the barber industry.
But it's also part about letting go of your pride in some cases, like being able to take a step back and recognize I need to do something different right now to get where I want to be.
Correct.
And then at some point, I can not work all day, all night, and be okay. But you have to sometimes take the journey to get there.
Yes, yes.
To the path of, to the road of success, I guess.
Yes. Yep.
That's good. So I got to tell you, I really appreciate your time talking to me. I mean, you have... And I think I keep wanting to end this conversation, but you keep giving me so many different other things to think about. I'm like, this dude. But I think like part of the thing is because you are a person who has a lot of, I would just say, you know, but the knowledge, I believe, and you have so many nuggets you could definitely drop in each conversation. So I think we definitely would do this again.
For sure.
in another format, but I think being able to just like to, bring your knowledge forward, I think, for people to hear, I think is key. Because I think one thing that we all know is that we learn by listening and watching other people.
Yes.
Social learning theory speaks a lot about we learn by watching and doing what other people have done. So being able to hear someone who talk about sacrifice and success, I think that's going to be key for all of us to hear more from you, Mr. Nafis Williams, and your journey. So I look forward to more conversation.
Yes, sir. I appreciate you, John. Dr. John Teller. Appreciate you.
All right, sir. Thank you. Have a, be well. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Later.
All right. All right. Thanks.